I'm Nancy Cavey, National ERISA and Individual Disability Attorney. Welcome to Winning Isn't Easy. Before we get started, I've got to give you a legal disclaimer. The Florida Bar Association says I have to tell you that this isn't legal advice, but nothing will ever prevent me from giving you easy to understand information and an overview of the disability insurance world, the games that carriers play, and what you need to know to get the disability benefits you deserve. So off we go. Do you have ME/CFS syndrome? If so, today's podcast is for you. If not, I still think there are lessons that you can learn from this podcast. Today, I'm going to talk about four things. The first thing is going to be ME/CFS syndrome and the eight common reasons why ME/CFS claims get denied. Two, evidence, examinations, and carrier reactions to ME/CFS syndrome, part one. Evidence, examinations, carrier reactions to ME/CFS fatigue syndrome, part two. And in conclusion, ME/CFS and its relationship to COVID-19 disability claims. We've got a lot to cover, but before we do that, we're going to take a quick break.
Have you been robbed of your peace of mind from your disability insurance carrier? You owe it to yourself to get a copy of Robbed of Your Peace of Mind, which provides you with everything you need to know about the long-term disability claim process. Request your free copy of the book at kvlaw.com today.
Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. Ready to get started? Let's first talk about ME/CFS and the eight common reasons why these claims get denied. But before we get started, I think we need to understand what the disease is and its symptoms. ME, which is also known as chronic fatigue syndrome, is, according to the Mayo Clinic, a disease characterized by profound fatigue, sleep abnormalities, pain, and other symptoms that are made worse by exertion. It occurs more commonly in women, and unfortunately the cause of this condition is unknown, but it can include environmental and genetic factors. Now, one of the characteristic symptoms of ME/CFS is fatigue over 6 months, and that fatigue often worsens with activity, but it doesn't improve with rest. There are, according to the Mayo Clinic, over 200,000 cases reported each year. Now, I'm going to be discussing how the chronic enterovirus infection, or CE, is possibly connected to ME/CFS. According to ME-opedia, though normally only capable of acute infections under certain conditions, these enteroviruses can create chronic infections. And the ongoing enterovirus infections can be found in ME/CFS cases and even several other chronic illnesses, including dilated cardiomyopathy and type 1 diabetes. Now, we need to also understand that the disability carriers don't understand these enteroviruses, much less the ME/CFS. And that can complicate a disability insurance claim and the carrier's approval of a claim. So let's talk about the eight reasons that disability carriers will use to justify a claim denial of ME/CFS claims or even chronic enterovirus infection claims. The disability insurance companies, like First Unum, have a laundry list of defenses they'll commonly raise in a disability insurance claim regarding CFS, chronic entero infections, and myalgic encephalomyelitis. They'll employ medical peer review providers to create these defenses. I call these medical providers liar for hires. There's big money to be made by providing these medical opinions, and big money made and saved by disability carriers. They no longer have to pay your disability benefits. So the role of the medical peer review provider is important for you to understand, because these are the people who are going to create the reasons that will justify the claims denial. They're hoping at some point that your treating physician won't support your claim, or they'll get tired of filling out forms or tired of being harassed by the disability insurance company. And when that doesn't work, or when the disability of definition of disability changes, or when the carrier is just flat out tired of paying your claim, the games will begin. And so what they'll do is they're going to assign a nurse case manager or a peer review physician to determine your quote unquote correct restrictions and limitations so that they can justify a denial of your benefits. The medical provider is either an on-site physician employed by the disability carrier, known as a medical director, or there are medical providers who have signed up with disability review companies to do medical reviews to supplement their income. Either way, these doctors are generally nothing more than hired guns. And that's why I call them liar for hire medical peer review providers. Now, it's common for the hired gun to contact your physician and seek a better understanding of their medical opinions, which is a code word for we want to convince you that your opinion's wrong or that you have no justification for your opinion and that our opinion regarding your restrictions and limitations are really correct, doctor, right? Now, obviously, the whole purpose of this is to ultimately create evidence, in quotes, to establish that you're capable of working. All right, so now we've kind of laid the base for this. We understand what ME/CFS is. We understand how the disability carriers are going to use these liar for hire doctors. So what are the 8 common reasons for the claims denial? Denial number 1 is there's no objective evidence of the diagnosis. They're, of course, going to say it's all in your head or it's, you know, something you're making up or you just could not be in as much pain as you complain of. Now, physicians will routinely rely on the complaints of patients in rendering opinions regarding the diagnosis and restrictions. And what they're going to be arguing, the disability carrier is going to be arguing, is that objective evidence is medically necessary in every case. And that can be difficult, if not impossible, to prove in cases like CFS, fibromyalgia, migraines, or even mental health impairments. There generally isn't objective evidence to confirm these conditions. But the good news, at least, is that courts across the country have repeatedly criticized and reversed denials based on a claimed lack of objective basis of the diagnosis. Denial reason number 2. There's no objective evidence for the restrictions and limitations assigned by the treating physician, or your doctor is improperly relying on your subjective complaints. This is a defense that has some traction with some courts. They want to see an objective basis for the restrictions and limitations assigned by your doctor. Now, because courts do uphold denials based on this argument, I think as a matter of proof, you get what's called a functional capacity evaluation, a cardiopulmonary exercise test, or a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation. The courts will recognize these tests as an objective basis for the assignment of restrictions and limitations. All right, denial reason number 3. There is no correlation between the findings to substantiate your reported complaints. So in other words, the medical reviewer is going to criticize the treating physician's records on the basis that there's an absence of correlating findings or studies that will substantiate your reported complaints or the level of your reported complaints. And often to get there, the medical reviewer will cherry pick the medical records and ignore objective findings that explain or are consistent with the disabling symptoms. Denial reason number 4, an absence of functional impairment. Now, that reason always amazes me because if you look at the disability policy, do you see functional impairment as a definition of disability? Rarely. Do you see a definition of impairment, much less functional impairment? You won't see either of those words used in a disability insurance policy. And the worst thing, I think, is the peer review doctor doesn't even define what they think functional impairment is or the standard that they use to determine whether or not there is a functional impairment. I think that's a bogus reason for denial, but it's a common one. All right, denial reason 5, unremarkable lab findings or diagnostic studies. Now, these liar for hire peer review doctors will often equate normal laboratory findings or diagnostic studies as evidence that there is no impairment. Well, you don't expect to see positive laboratory or diagnostic findings in cases of ME/CFS. These medical conditions generally are not established through objective medical evidence, such as diagnostic studies or testing. I mean, just think about it. Is there a test that will prove that you have a migraine? Well, if you have a brain CT scan and there's a tumor, then that may be the basis for the reason for the migraine. But that is an example of another medical condition where there are either no lab findings or unremarkable diagnostic studies. That doesn't negate the diagnosis of migraines, much less the diagnosis of ME/CFS. So think about that argument in relationship to perhaps a migraine claim. Now, unfortunately, that doesn't prevent them from hanging their hat on that to justify a claims denial. Reason number six is there's medical improvement. So on the flip side of this, the medical reviewer will comment that recent office notes reflect overall improvement. And then they'll jump to the conclusion, one, that there's improvement, and two, that that level of improvement allows you to work. But what is improvement? And is that improvement temporary or is it permanent? Is it enough to permit you to return to work? Of course, the peer reviewer provider never considers or answers those questions. Denial reason number seven is that the level of care isn't enough. Is your head spinning yet? The medical reviewer will often comment that the lack of escalating care or medication is inconsistent with a level of reported impairment, pain, or fatigue. And as a result, you magically are capable of working. Now, of course, the peer review provider hasn't commented on the care that you've gotten and your lack of improvement as a result of that care. Nonetheless, they are going to criticize the level of care and use that as a reason to deny your claim. Denial reason number eight, there are no side effects from medication and therefore you ought to be able to work. Now that of course is not always true. Medications like Benadryl, Zoloft, lorazepam, Adderall, Lyrica, a whole stable of medications are used in ME/CFS cases. And they have reported side effects. Now, what the peer review provider will do is scour the medical records looking for medication side effects. And if they don't find any, they're going to opine that there are no medication side effects. Now, that may not always be true. And quite frankly, the doctor probably told you when they prescribed the medication that there would be side effects. And so you're not necessarily going to report to the doctor anything abnormal because the doctor told you that you would normally have those kinds of problems. Yet, because there's no medication side effects noted in the records, the peer review doctor is then going to say, well, since there are no medication side effects noted, that can't impact the person's ability to work, and therefore they can work because they're getting a good result. Or if there are medication side effects, they'll say, well, they don't rise to the level of impairment warranting any restrictions and limitations. In other words, they're playing both sides of this game. What's important here is that that's not the standard of disability, and they will purposely fail to address the known side effects caused by combinations of medications, much less the medications that are being prescribed. So that's another common reason for denial. Now, let's take a quick break before we head into our next section. And while we do that, think about those eight reasons. Has your claim been denied because of any of those eight reasons? Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. This is an episode chock full of information, and we're going to keep on going. Let's talk about the evidence examination and carrier's reaction to ME/CFS claims, part one. Now, I've talked about the objective evidence of your diagnosis issue. ME/CFS generally has no universally agreed upon diagnostic criteria. And what the disability carriers will use is an outdated CDC definition. And according to that definition, you have to have significantly lowered ability to participate in activities that were routine before the onset of the condition and persisting for more than 6 months. Physical or mental activity that causes worsening of symptoms that would not have happened before, sleep disturbance, a constellation of symptoms that can't be explained by any other clinical diagnosis. Now, then they're going to be looking at some other factors. They're going to be looking at whether or not you have difficulty with thinking and memory, worsening problems with sitting or standing, muscle pain, joint pain, or headache pain, tender lymph nodes in the neck or armpits, night sweats, or sensitivity to foods, odors, chemicals, or noise. Now, they're also going to be applying this objective evidence test to restrictions and limitations. So they're going to cherry pick the medical records to see whether or not you have any of these complaints. And then they're going to look for the objective evidence of restrictions and limitations. Where's that evidence going to come from? Well, it potentially can come from the statements that you make to the disability carrier on a phone call or on a phone call check-in. It can be found in the statements that you make on your activity of daily living forms. It can be coming from statements of your supervisors or coworkers. It can be coming from supportive medical records from your physician. It can also come from the APS statement that you will get from your physician, or even Social Security disability forms, such as a residual functional capacity form for ME/CFS. It can come from a functional capacity evaluation, a CPET exam, neurocognitive testing, an independent examination, and a vocational report, and maybe even a Social Security decision. But you got to be careful about that because of mental health issues. So those are sources that either you can submit or they'll be looking for not only an objective basis of the diagnosis, but objective basis of the restrictions and limitations. Now, I've talked before about the importance of a CPET examination in an ME/CFS case. Why? Well, as I've told you before, they're going to argue that there is no objective basis for the diagnosis, notwithstanding the fact that ME/CFS can't be established through objective medical evidence. Courts are generally not impressed with that argument at all. But as I've said before, the next argument that they're going to make is that your records don't support a level of impairment that would prevent you from being entitled to your benefits because you can't do the material and substantial duties of your own occupation or any other occupation. So the way to solve that is to get a CPET exam, because that CPET exam can objectively measure fatigue and other symptoms that can interfere with your ability to work. But you need to understand that there are two types of CPET exams. There's a one-day and a two-day, and there are advantages and disadvantages to each. Regardless of which one you get, they can be hard to obtain because there are very few facilities that will perform these. Now, the one-day CPET can be obtained by a cardiologist or an exercise physiologist. I'm leery about testing done by a cardiologist because, quite frankly, they're not as sympathetic as to why you're getting the testing an exercise physiologist. The exercise physiologist, I think, is better qualified because they understand the impact of exercise and fatigue on a person's ability to work from the person's totality of their situation. Where cardiologists will just sort of tend to focus on potentially fatigue issues and not deal with the other issues, such as pain or dysfunction, the impact of other medical conditions. So I prefer a CPET exam done by an exercise physiologist. But the problem with a one-day CPET exam is that it rarely addresses the major problem in ME/CFS cases, which is the post-exertional malaise. That's why I think you're probably better off getting the more expensive two-day CPET. It can, as I said, be difficult to find one. And you may have to go to New York, Washington State, California, or even Florida, where testing can be done. And I understand that adds to the expense. So you probably should be consulting with an experienced ERISA disability attorney before you do the CPET exam, because they can tell you who to use and explain to you why you might need a one-day or a two-day exam. Now, there are situations where my clients will have a two-day CPET exam scheduled, but they don't pass the first day. And as a result, we don't have to do the second day. But if you pass the first day, then we definitely need the second day because we want to document the fatigue and cognitive issues. Now, what is the disability carrier's common response to a CPET exam? They will, quite frankly, look for ways to discredit the exam. And the first way they will do it is to say, well, it's not time relevant, because it doesn't address the functionality at the time the claim was denied. And I don't really think that courts buy that argument, in part because disability carriers do IMEs all the time after the time cases have been denied. So you can't argue that out of both sides of your mouth. Now, if that doesn't work, what they're going to argue is that the CPET exam was not supported by the physical examination conducted by the treating physicians, the level of treatment provided, or the nature of the treatment recommendations. I always want to get my treating physician to sign off on the CPET exam results. And now, the last argument they're going to make is that the CPET is not objective evidence of impairment because it's based on subjective information supplied by the policyholder. And I don't think that that argument goes, quite frankly, very far with the courts, who have recognized the CPET exam as the gold standard examination or study to document the existence of ME/CFS, but also the level of restrictions and limitations. Got it? All right, let's take a quick break before we come back and talk about part two of evidence examination and carrier reactions to ME/CFS syndrome claims.
Are you a professional with questions about your individual disability policy? You need the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. This book gives you a comprehensive understanding of your disability policy with tips and to-dos regarding your disability application that will assist you in submitting a winning disability application. This is one you won't want to miss. For the next 24 hours, we are giving away free copies of the Disability Insurance Claim Survival Guide for Professionals. Order yours today at disabilityclaimsforprofessionals.com.
Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. Evidence, Examination, and Carrier Reactions to ME/CFS Fatigue Syndrome Claims, Part 2. Now, one of the games that a disability carrier is going to play is that you really have a psychiatric impairment and you don't have a claim based on ME/CFS. So as a result, we're only going to limit the pay your benefits for 2 years. Now, let me give you an example of how this works. And this is the case of Tam versus First Unum Life Insurance Company. It's a California case. And I think it explains and illustrates how disability carriers will play this game. Ms. Tam was a software engineer and she suffered from ME/CFS. She applied for it. She was granted her short-term disability benefits after undergoing a carrier IME that amazingly found that she was severely impaired. The IME noted that she was depressed, anxious, and tearful during the IME. And the IME concluded that she had major depression secondary to ME/CFS. So she then applied for her long-term disability benefits. What did First Unum do? Well, First Unum made it clear that she was not disabled by her mental health conditions. They were looking for a way to deny this claim any way they could. So she asked Unum to review her claim only from her physical conditions. And then Unum, as always, had the claim reviewed by four physicians. One was an occupational medicine doctor, another was an internist, and neither was qualified to evaluate her medical conditions. And that's a common tactic. They'll use the wrong kind of doctor. Now, notwithstanding her request, Unum had a psychiatrist, Dr. Kletty, review the case, although he didn't examine her. He noted her history of mental health treatment, her prescriptions, and her psychological issues. And Dr. Kletty commented that her symptom complaints, particularly her fatigue and cognitive dysfunction, were common in psychiatric illnesses. And in fact, that's true. But he went off on a tangent that resulted in the denial. Kletty said, look, I've looked at her medical records and her infectious medicine doctors make no comment of any psychiatric concerns, conditions, or impairments. Well, that was wrong. And what Kletty did and what is common is they'll cherry pick the medical records to again, create a reason for denial. Now, Kletty also disagreed with the medical opinions provided by the short-term disability provider, psychiatric IME. So in other words, Kletty disagreed with Unum's IME doctor. And that's a common ploy too, where there'll be a disagreement among experts, and under the terms of the disability policy, the carrier gets to pick who they believe. And who are they going to believe? Not the favorable psychiatric or physical IME they picked, but the peer review doctor who, the liar for hire, who is going to say, well, no, that doctor was really wrong. Now, for unknown reasons, Unum retained another psychiatrist to review her claim, the infamous Stuart Shipko. And Shipko is well known in the ERISA world I'll just say Google him and look at the cases he's been involved in, and you can get a clue as to what Dr. Shipko is about. Now, Shipko did not examine her and, of course, disagreed with the IME doctor. And as a result, Unum denied her claim. So Tam said, well, I'm not going to stand for this. And she submitted additional testing, including a neuropsychological evaluation to document her cognitive problems. Well, what did Unum do? Well, Unum had their file reviewed by a fifth doctor, Dr. Norris. Dr. Norris specializes in family medicine, occupational medicine, and aerospace medicine. He didn't examine her. Of course, he has no experience or training in her underlying medical conditions, nor is he a neuropsychologist. So what did Norris do? Norris said, well, it's not time relevant. I'm going to throw this out. And her denial was upheld because Unum said she could do the duties of her regular occupation. And fortunately, Tam went into federal court, and the judge was not impressed by the Unum denial, notwithstanding the fact that there were five peer-reviewed doctors. The judge criticized Unum for using doctors that weren't competent or qualified or to address her multiple medical conditions. And he noted that Kletty and Shipko focused on the psychiatric aspects of her condition, even though that wasn't the basis of her claim. And the judge commented that peer review providers conducted by Unum's physicians mischaracterized or ignored the evidence in the record, citing the errors made by Kletty and Shipko. Now, this is common. But the court went on and criticized Unum's demand that Tam submit objective evidence of a medical condition characterized by a subjective complaint of fatigue and pain, and also criticized Unum's rejection of the neuropsychological evaluation, which addressed the impact of the ME/CFS on her cognitive abilities. The court said, look, we think this information is time relevant. These tests should have been considered in combination with all the medical records. And the court noted that there wasn't any basis for challenging her credibility. Unum never had her undergo an IME, never questioned her honesty or integrity, had a doctor physically examine her and determine whether or not she was malingering or faking on her examination. And fortunately, and congratulations to Ms. Tam, they awarded her benefits. And the court noted that the testing was a valid and credible measure of her medical conditions. So we need to understand that we have the burden of proof in every claim, including an ME/CFS claim. And there are ways, again, to address these issues with the support of a treating physician who will fill out the residual functional capacity form, the strength of your medical records based on your history of your complaints and problems with functionality, a CPET exam, an FCE, and even a neuropsychological exam. We really do want to create a body of medical and vocational evidence that establishes that you can't perform the material and substantial duties of your own occupation. So you can see that these cases can be hard to develop, and you really, in my opinion, need the experience and support of an ERISA disability attorney who can help review your medical records, review the policy, and develop not only the medical but the vocational evidence that will establish that you objectively have ME/CFS, that you have objective restrictions and limitations that prevent you from performing your own or any occupation, and take apart with a sledgehammer all the bogus defense reasons the carriers will use to deny a claim. All right, let's take a break. Welcome back to Winning Isn't Easy. ME/CFS claims and their relationship to COVID-19 disability claims. Now, why am I bringing this up? I'm bringing this up because COVID-19 and ME/CFS are different diseases, but the symptoms can overlap. And I find that insurance companies tend to treat claims made by sufferers of both diseases very similar. Now, many people who unfortunately have had COVID have gone on to develop long-term COVID-19 symptoms. They're called COVID long haulers. This name can trivialize the symptoms, which need to be not only recognized and diagnosed, but properly treated. And I think this is much like what happened to those who were ultimately diagnosed with ME/CFS many years ago. Dr. Fauci has said that the long hauler syndrome is really real and it's quite extensive, much like in the early days of ME/CFS. The disease is real and it's quite extensive, but it took a long time for the medical community to recognize ME/CFS, and worse, it took disability carriers even longer to recognize ME/CFS as disabling. Now, what they always argue is that there isn't any specific diagnosis for the persistent symptoms of ME/CFS. And they do that in COVID cases. They'll say there's no specific diagnosis for the persistent symptoms of COVID-19. They never really got, for quite some time, the disabling symptoms of ME/CFS. And that's happening in COVID-19 cases. They don't get the disabling symptoms of COVID-19. And much like back in the early days of ME/CFS, and even continuing today, the disability carrier plays on the subjective nature of ME/CFS. And they're doing that in COVID-19 claims. So I think that if you have a COVID-19 claim, that you can look to how ME/CFS claims were handled for guidance. And I think that there are four issues. There are four issues, much like ME/CFS claims. So what I'm saying is also applicable to ME/CFS claims. Issue one is that the carriers like to deny or contest claims because of lack of objective diagnosis. Now, one of the leading medical specialists in ME/CFS told me recently that their practice expects to see an increase in misdiagnosed patients because physicians don't know how to deal with COVID-19 claims. They don't know how to diagnose the symptoms. They don't know how to develop treatment for these symptoms. And as a result, much like ME/CFS, there is generally not one physician who handles all these symptoms, nor is there a hard diagnosis for the symptoms. And as a result, unfortunately, I think it's going to be a long journey for some COVID long-haul survivors to deal with this particular problem, much like it was in the early days of ME/CFS. Issue number two is the subjective nature of the symptoms and the subjective medical condition limitation in a policy. Now, ME/CFS and COVID-19 symptoms and complaints can't always be objectively measured. There are some disability policies that have provisions called subjective medical condition limitations. They will limit the period of time in which you get benefits. The clause will generally say that if you have symptoms associated with body pain, fatigue, cognitive issues, that we're only going to pay benefits for 2 years. Now, that can be an issue, particularly, I think, if the symptoms are the manifestation of an objective medical condition like ME/CFS or COVID-19. Because I think that a poorly written subjective medical condition limitation opens the doors for an argument that benefits should be paid because those subjective symptoms are based or are the manifestation of an objective diagnosis. But there are also more broadly written subjective medical condition limitations that say, look, we're only going to pay 2 years of benefits for medical conditions characterized by pain, muscle joint pain, headaches, ME/CFS, COVID-19, et cetera, et cetera. So they'll actually name the disease in addition to the symptoms. That, of course, can be problematic. And that might, in fact, be a valid limitation. There are, again, reasons why you might want to have an FCE or a cardiac pulmonary function test to document the objective basis of the symptoms and how they impact your ability to function. But that really is going to be a product, in my view, of the subjective medical condition clause, if there is one in your policy. Now, another issue, number three, is the mental nervous condition limitation. There are also mental nervous condition limitations in policies that can limit the payment of benefits to 2 years if a psychiatric illness is the cause of the disability. There are policies that are broadly written, much like the subjective medical condition limitation, that says, if your medical condition contributes ever so slightly to your disability, your benefits are limited to just 2 years. I call this the Monty Python wafer thin limitation in mental nervous conditions. Now, unfortunately, it's common for COVID-19 and ME/CFS sufferers to have the cognitive issues. And carriers will misclassify those as psychiatric in nature on purpose to try to apply the mental nervous condition limitation. And then, of course, issue number four in both ME/CFS cases and COVID-19 cases are treatment issues. Policies require that you get recognized treatment and that you comply with that treatment program. There is generally no recognized treatment protocol to address COVID long-haul sufferers' problems, particularly since COVID-19 has multi-symptom impact. So you can have problems with your heart, your lungs, your vascular system, neurological system. You can have cognitive issues. And the lack of treatment protocol or one-stop doctor, if you will, to treat those problems can play into the hands of a disability carrier who's looking for a reason to deny a claim. So we need to understand that there's just a host of reasons that these claims are going to be potentially denied, both based on the subjective nature of the condition, the lack of objective findings, policy term limitations, and treatment issues. If you have any questions about your rights to long-term disability benefits as a result of ME/CF or COVID-19, this is an area where you really do need the assistance of an experienced disability attorney. I think that there are some lessons that you can be learned from contested ME/CFS claims that apply to COVID-19 claims. The first is that unlike ME/CFS, it's hard to pretend or argue that you didn't have COVID-19. I think the other lesson is that research into the basis of ME/CFS could be the starting point to begin understanding what has happened in the case of COVID long haulers. But I will tell you again that the treatment, diagnosis, and handling of ME/CFS claims is going to be the model that disability carriers are using. In fact, I'm seeing it right now to deny these COVID-19 long-term, long-haul claims. So, and I think that the other point I want to make is that unlike ME/CFS, COVID-19 will cause pulmonary, gastroenterological, neurological, and vascular issues. And these cases, I think, are a bit more complex than an ME/CFS case. And I know that sounds amazing, but I think that disability carriers are going to want to see specialty evaluations, treatments, and opinions if you have pulmonary, gastroenterological, neurological, or vascular issues that are going to be addressed as part of a disability claim. Having handled many ME/CFS and COVID-19 claims, I understand that these claims are complicated, and this is not an area where I think that you should be handling your claim by yourself. So I hope that you have learned not only information about ME/CFS, but that you've learned how the COVID-19 claims are going to be handled. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. If you like this podcast, consider liking our page, leaving a review, or sharing it with your friends or family. And remember, our podcast comes out weekly. So stay tuned for next week's episode of Winning Isn't Easy. Thanks.